This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Emma Barnett and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4. We'll have details for you today of what's being described as a blockbuster immunotherapy drug which could help thousands more women with breast cancer than previously thought. Carolyn Hunter will be here. Her story with her daughter Freya of sky-high energy bills on account of the electricity needed to power Freya's life-supporting machines went viral after the actor Kate Winslet donated thousands to help the family. But how are they doing now? We're going to catch up with Carolyn. And the journalist and author, Rose Hackman, will be here to argue why we need to stop indulging the idea of women's intuition. More to be revealed shortly, but it has something to do with emotional labour. All that to come and more. But first, a few weeks ago, you may remember I spoke to the founder of the baby loss charity, Mariposa Trust, Zoe Clark-Coates, about her tireless campaign for baby loss certificates to be issued by the government. After 9 long years, they were finally introduced in England last month for parents who've lost a baby before 24 weeks of pregnancy. It was a particularly emotional conversation, as you may expect, in which Zoe opened up about her own baby losses, and I'm very grateful to her for feeling like she could. But during our conversation, I realised that I too could apply for one of these certificates. I lost a baby at the start of 2022, an experience despite being very well aware of how common miscarriage is, you somehow never think will happen to you. I particularly and very naively really didn't think it would, as it had taken 5 rounds of IVF to finally fall pregnant again, 4 years after the birth of mine and my husband's son. But it did happen. I lost the baby and with it I was forever changed. But apart from what went on inside of me and some of the conversations we had in the days and weeks afterwards, there was nothing else. Like millions of women before me, the baby lived within me and died within me. My body and mind, the keeper and witness. Not that you have to have something, but these baby loss certificates spoke to me. So after the programme last month, I went online. I didn't give it any more thought. I just knew instinctively I wanted to, becoming part of the first wave of women in England to apply for this document. I messaged my husband to explain what I was planning to do, asking, of course, if he was comfortable with it. I was going to put his name down and I didn't want him to receive an email asking for his consent without prior warning, and he was. I should say you don't have to access your medical notes, nor is the process limited to one baby loss. But filling in the form, it actually only took a matter of minutes, but it was more emotional than I had anticipated. One of the questions you're asked is when you lost your baby. I realised I didn't actually know what month, and at that point even year. If you can relate to any of this, you'll know that that time is a fog and there's a moment before the sonographer tells you the news, if that's the way you find out, as I did, and after. But I felt the act of applying for a baby loss certificate almost to be a political one, a refusal that something so major in our family's life was not to be erased, was something to be known about, recorded. And when the certificate arrived, a mere 10 days later, in its crisp envelope, I sort of wondered what this was when it dropped through the door, and printed on thick white paper, complete with an official government masthead, I've got it here in the studio, I felt weirdly satisfied, almost vindicated. It had happened. There was some physical proof that something external to me, which my husband and our children, here it was, when they're older, could read as part of the story of our lives, alongside perhaps our marriage certificates, birth certificates, and all the other paraphernalia that documents our existences in a family file of sorts. Our certificate, when I take it back home, will be filed in the folder alongside the birth certificates of our other children. Children I am so very fortunate to have. And I wanted to share my experience of applying and receiving these new baby loss certificates in a bid to raise awareness of the new scheme and explore some of the issues around it, which I'm going to be helped by your messages to do so today, and two guests. Many of you have already been in touch. If you feel you would like to, the number is 84844. Text will be charged at your standard message rate. On social media, we're at BBC Woman's Hour. You can email me through the Woman's Hour website or send a WhatsApp on 03 700 100 444. I should also say that support services are available on the Woman's Hour website. Your stories include, though, messages where it's not for you. It isn't something you want to do, and I'm very mindful of that. Others, though, who've applied straight away, and you also perhaps now have a certificate or are waiting for one. I received a message only this morning from a woman who said that she would be giving some feedback because hers arrived on Mother's Day. And we have received many messages from those of you who don't yet qualify. I just want to say this at this point. It's described at the moment as a deadline for recent losses since the 1st of September 2018. We have a message here from Pat who said, I lost my babies in the late 70s and my daughter hers in the early 2010s. We also still grieve and have nothing to confirm their existence. Pat, I want to reassure you and many, many others that that was a temporary and is apparently a temporary date just to avoid the system being overwhelmed. It will be removed and you will be able to apply. We'll bring you that update on the programme and I'm sure the government will, of course, update its services too. A message here from Val says, I had a miscarriage at 11 weeks in the early 70s. However, because pregnancy testing before 12 weeks was not available, it was not registered as a miscarriage. There was no support for me, medical or otherwise. It would be good to have some acknowledgement of this, as there must be millions like me. And another one here talking about this temporary cut-off date, also trying to reassure people of that. And Naomi has messaged to say, we had our losses in 2016 and 2017, and I have decided I will not be applying for certificates, mainly because I feel I've dealt with those emotions. We have two lovely children now, and I do not want to go back to that dark place. It was an awful time in our lives, and now we are in a different place. I'm joined by Dr. Michelle Tolfrey. Good morning.
Good morning.
And you are here with your professional hat, I suppose, in some ways on as a psychotherapist.
A psychologist.
Psychologist. Yeah. But you are also here as a woman with experience.
Yes. Yeah.
And a view that perhaps, well, in some cases, does differ to mine in terms of these certificates. Tell us a bit more.
So my experience is that I've had two losses. I've had an early loss, which was an ectopic pregnancy. And I also had a later loss. So my first daughter was stillborn at full term. So I have these really contradictory experiences of having a loss where I have nothing. I have no record. I have no mementos, no memories from that pregnancy. And then I have a certificate of stillbirth for my daughter, which was required by law. It was something I had to do. You, at that point, I don't know if it's different now, but had to go to a registry office where there's lots of other live babies to register the existence of the baby that was born but had died before she was born. And when it was announced that these certificates were going to be launched, I had these really conflicting feelings because I felt like I should want to apply for a certificate. So I have this almost full record of my reproductive history, my reproductive story. But there was something within me that felt like that just wasn't going to be the right thing for me right now. And I think as a psychologist, as a mother, I've gone over and over and over about why is this? What is it about this that just doesn't feel right for me right now? And I think it's really embedded in the story about that particular loss. I didn't know I was pregnant until it was catastrophically ending. I found out I was pregnant and then wheeled down for surgery a few hours later to save my life. it was treated as a medical emergency because it was. Mm. And at no point, my care was amazing, but at no point was my care, it wasn't framed as I was losing a baby. It was, this is really dangerous. We need to take you for surgery. So I was, I was kept in for a night. I was sent home. But, at no point was I sort of told you might want follow-up to think about this or to explore this. So I felt like that set the wheels in motion for how I was supposed to feel about this loss. I didn't access any help. I didn't know that there was kind of support out there. I didn't know there was this huge, amazing baby loss community until I then lost my daughter a year later. And it was then that I thought, crikey, maybe I was allowed to feel sad about that loss. Maybe I could have felt sad about it. Maybe I could have grieved. And then by that point, I think I was so traumatised, so burnt out with my grief for the daughter who had just been stillborn, that I felt like I couldn't go back there. Mm. And, I've been very lucky to go on to have another daughter, and a number of years have passed. And I just worry that to go and apply for a certificate, I know how meaningful they are. I know how meaningful they are to so many people. And for me, I wonder whether then I would need to go and kind of really bond with this baby in my mind that I actually hadn't allowed to build in my mind. This was a baby that I didn't know when their due date would be. I hadn't thought of names because I didn't have that time to bond with this baby in my mind. And I worry that it's not going to be the right thing for me right now. Mm. To go there and start to build that kind of deeper relationship and connection. That's not to say I won't in the future, but right now this feels like the right thing for me. And I'm sure there's lots of people out there who are in a similar position, maybe who've had multiple losses, maybe many, many losses, and feel conflicted that they might want to apply for one and not the other, or for all of them or for none of them. And I think that it's just acknowledging that we have to do what's right for us rather than what we feel like is the right thing to do that other people might deem as right.
Thank you for sharing that. And also, I'm incredibly sorry for your losses.
Thank you.
And I think what you've spoken to is how some people can't go back and don't want to.
Yeah.
Or they feel very differently about that in the way they may then feel about subsequent losses as well. And I think also for this, some people don't feel they're allowed to feel that there was a loss, because, and I was reflecting on this, the need for those around you who love you, for them to see you move on, to focus on the good, to focus on the living is huge.
Absolutely.
And let's just, we're good, we're here. You might not be good, but let's say you feel like you are in a much better place. Yeah. It's a frightening thing to go back. Do you see that as some of the reason why people may not feel they can or should?
Definitely. Because I think it's a bit like a jigsaw puzzle or a sort of Jenga puzzle that if you move one of these parts, there's a fear that, well, what's that going to mean for all the other parts? How do I make sense of all these other parts of my story? How do I make sense of, would this subsequent child have been conceived? These are all sort of big things that I think they're very moving, they're very emotive. And, I think unless you've maybe been through that experience and explored it in a lot of depth, it's really hard to understand how meaningful all of these different parts of our story are.
Talking to you a bit more in your role as a psychologist, do you think they can be also helpful for partners and for those around, that sort of externalisation of something?
Definitely, definitely. I think that there is something about having something physical, which as humans helps us to know that things exist. Mm. That's why people keep their pregnancy tests. There are people who keep lots of those, people who keep...
I don't know where you're meant to keep them. I have quite a few. Yeah, I mean, it's quite a gross thing because you've peed on it. Just to lighten the mood for one moment.
But it's so true.
Keeping a pee stick. It's obviously so much more than that.
Absolutely. That's it. Exactly. These are really powerful objects of attachment to that part of your life, to that person, to that imagined baby, that baby that you are already starting to bond with at that moment. So, if you don't have those things, if you don't have, I'm very lucky, I guess, with my daughter who was stillborn. I have photographs. I have pieces of clothing that she wore. I have nothing of that for my earlier loss, like so many other people. I don't even have a scan picture. So these objects and these photos and these things, these mementos, are powerful, and they reconnect us to a time and a place and a part of our history. And these certificates will be another part of that.
Let's go through some of these messages today that we're receiving, and also some that had come in before the programme. There's one here. Listening to you today while I shed a few tears, like so many, I've shared your experience. Sadly, my two miscarriages took place in between our second and third children, but before 2018, so I can't apply yet. But when I can, I will, for the political reasons you mention. And also, I still feel the losses, despite being lucky to have the children I do, and want those babies to be remembered and not forgotten, not just by me, but by their brothers, who at the time never knew, says Sarah, listening in North London. Good morning. The miscarriage certificate reads, this message would also be useful for men. When my wife and I lost our twins in 2004, it was the closest that I've personally been to suicide. It still affects both of us massively, despite having two beautiful and amazing children now. And at the time, my employer was awful. And as an engineering consultancy business, they really didn't understand how miscarriage can affect men too, says Ken. Ken, thank you very much for feeling you could share that. I lost an early pregnancy, reads this message, which was unplanned and which my husband did not really want. I feel that nobody knew or wanted that baby other than me, and I feel weirdly hindered from getting this certificate because the pregnancy almost happened in a silent vacuum. I fear I've buried that loss too deep and I chose to forget it. It's a very interesting one again. This is just highly personal, mm-hmm. and highly specific. My daughter-in-law, who lives overseas, lost her second baby before 12 weeks in 2015. Other than telling close family, my son and daughter-in-law didn't want to speak about it. It's never been referred to again. But listening to Emma this morning brought me back to the fact that I lost my second grandchild. Luckily, they went on to have another in 2017, so now I have two lovely, healthy granddaughters. But the loss of that grandchild is still there. A different perspective. A message here from Louise talking about perhaps not being ready yet for a baby loss certificate. I had my first daughter in 2018, a really easy pregnancy and a quick birth, considering I'd had a stroke aged 30 in 2014, something I wasn't sure was possible. I then had my first miscarriage on the day of the first lockdown, the 23rd of March 2020, at 9 weeks. I went on to have three miscarriages all in 2020, the first two at 9 weeks and then the third a few days before our 12-week scan. I went to all three scans and medical appointments alone, something I'm sure that's causing me trauma even now. Gosh. I was lucky and gave birth to my second daughter in 2020. I have heard about the baby loss certificates, and while I think they are a good idea, I can't even bring myself to go on the website. It's weird, as I think maybe it would help me. It's also wrapped up in the trauma for which I'm having counselling to unpick at the moment. I don't really feel anything about the miscarriages other than feeling I should be sad. My husband says that while I was the one who physically went through the miscarriages and we have our second daughter, and he doesn't really think of them and doesn't think of the miscarriages. That's a message there from Louise. Thank you very much for getting in touch and feeling you can share that. Holly Scott's on the line now. Holly, good morning.
Good morning, Emma. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. And I understand you have received your baby loss certificates. Is that right?
Yes, I have. So I have four in total.
I'm sorry.
The last 3.5 years for us have been very much about, first of all, it was having our first baby, who we did get around to having in January 2022, but we had two losses in the lead up to having her. And we've had two since, in sort of trying to get there a second time.
I'm very sorry. Very sorry.
Thank
indeed.
You.
And you have also moved, I suppose, relatively fast to apply and have these certificates. What did it mean to you? Why did you want to do this?
Well, the funny thing is that initially I wasn't sure that it was for me. I had been following the progress of the work that Zoe had been doing. I knew they were in the pipeline. And as they were sort of gaining a bit more traction in the news and the launch was approaching, I just felt myself kind of compelled to be involved in that conversation. And before I knew it, the morning that they were launched, as the first thing that I did when I woke up, I found myself on the website pouring these details into my phone just to apply for them. And within 15 minutes, they were all done. It was weirdly something I didn't think that I needed, but it turns out that it was really cathartic to put all that information somewhere outside of my brain, outside of my body.
Yes.
I was quite surprised by how therapeutic it felt.
And what was it like to receive them?
It kind of surprised me again, I think, because they're very official documents, as you will have seen. They come in a big envelope with hard backing from the government. It looks very official. And I thought, oh, my goodness, what are these? And then suddenly remembered, like, oh, gosh, of course, that's what they are. And, you know, I skimmed over them and I felt a real sense of relief, I think, and reassurance. It was so validating to see these experiences somewhere physical that I could touch, and I knew I'm not going to be displaying them or anything like that. They're going to go, like you said, in a family file, but they exist outside of my mind and body, and that is validating and reassuring. And it sort of is proof that these experiences happen, that these pregnancies and babies did exist, which is hugely reassuring.
And have you found it as a family? How's that work? Because we've been hearing a little bit about partners, and also we've heard from a grandparent now. You know, just has there been any additional side of this having something physical, do you think, for your wider group?
It's been quite private, just between something between my husband and I. And I told him and asked for his consent just to make sure that he didn't get sort of bowled over by 4 emails asking for his permission. But I think they're more for me than they are for him. He completely respects and recognizes that they have value. But I think I'm not sure that he's really looked at them more than a couple of seconds. And I think they're more for me than they are for him. I think it's a physical thing to do. It's my body. They lived and also died inside me. And I think it's more for me than it is for him, to be honest.
And for now, I mean, you know, I'm just looking at the paper in case anybody is more interested about what you have to supply. I mean, there's all the information online, but there's also, the details asking if the sex was known, the date of the loss, the place of the loss, and also the name of the baby, if you had a nickname, if you had somewhere that you'd got to with that. I personally actually didn't on that front, but I think, you know, seeing those things written down, any of those details written down, it's quite an extraordinary thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an experience which is very private. We actually only named one of ours, the one that we sort of got furthest along in gestation, and was also the most sort of traumatic to bring to a close. So we sort of decided on a nickname between us, and that's the first time I'd ever put it down somewhere. It's the first time I'd ever written it. And there was, again, excuse me, sorry, there was something very powerful in doing that.
Well, thank you for feeling like you could talk about it this morning. It is a new thing, you know, to be able to, in England certainly. And all the details about the other areas of the UK online as well. But it is a new thing. And I think when something's new, you know, part of it's just explaining how you can do it, and also perhaps why you do it, and what you're going to do since doing it. Holly Scott, thank you very much. There's more messages coming in terms of where you are with this. Haley has said, I have lost 5 babies in total. 4 of these were early miscarriages. 1 was the loss of my son, Peter, when I was 22 weeks pregnant. 4 of my pregnancies were the result of IVF, and me and my husband are still on our fertility journey to hopefully get to bring home one of our children one day. I have applied for a baby loss certificate for our son. I believe strongly that all steps that can be taken to recognise the lives of lost babies are so important. Following my labour to deliver Peter, it meant so much to me that the midwife weighed him, helped me to choose a little outfit for him, and handled him in the same way she would have if he had been born alive. These small gestures to recognise and respect him as a person were huge for me. When my son arrived silently onto the hospital bed, the midwife's first words were, "He's beautiful." Those 2 words will be with me forever. He was beautiful. He deserved to be recognised and remembered. It was heartbreaking knowing that his birth would not be registered. These new baby loss certificates are such an important step for mothers like me. Hayley, I'm incredibly sorry. But again, thank you for sharing your message. And so they carry on, many more coming in. I hope in some way that our discussion and going back to this now, they've started arriving, these baby loss certificates for those who would like them, those who are able to apply, but that will be changing. I hope that the ability to have this conversation this morning perhaps gives, again, another external place to be able to talk about what was and what perhaps nearly was, and for that to seem real. Just because if I can, just to come back to you finally, Dr. Michelle Tolfrey, is a psychologist who speaks to women. Mm. That psychology of the relationship that's just inside you and that bond, it's not even a bond perhaps at first, it's just a conversation, you know, starting between two people, and then that getting to know and that intensification of it, and how to make that feel real is very important, isn't it?
It's really important. I think people need to feel that they have all the opportunities available to do that in whatever means feels right for them. And I think I've been struck by sort of listening to you read up people's comments about you know, particularly people reflecting on this being really important, being a political issue, and also just that element of choice that people might apply for some losses, not for others. And I think that that's been one of the most wonderful things about this, is empowering people to really think about, is this right for you, rather than in another thing being enforced on people that you can or you can't. This is giving an opportunity for people to stop and reflect, and that there's no rush. I think that this is something that you don't have to rush to do it. And it's meaningful, it's emotive, so we should take our time and get support in doing that. You know, if you need to talk to someone before doing it, or talk to someone to help you through that process, because those questions like, did you know the gender? Do you have a name? Would you like to give this baby a name? Did you have a nickname? They're really moving things, and we might need someone to sit alongside us as we delve into that and explore that and sort of bring that, kind of almost solidify that bond and thicken that story. You know, we shouldn't feel like we have to do that on our own.
Yes, and I did say it before, but I'll say it again. If you do require support, we will provide some links on the Women's Hour website, as we often do after difficult discussions. There's a message here from Anne I wanted to share, which said, I miscarried in 2001 after surgery enabled me to conceive. The feeling of physical and emotional emptiness was huge. I buried the scan report, the only physical manifestation of the pregnancy I had left, in the garden. The idea of a certificate to commemorate an otherwise buried loss really speaks to me, and I shall be applying when the scheme opens up to those other dates. Anne, again, I'm very sorry indeed, and thank you for that message and being able to share such a personal decision. Your messages are coming in, and many of them, as you can imagine. It would be very important to try to come back to some of them, but we'll also keep a record and see if we can pull some of your messages together as well. But I know that, you know, when we do get lots of messages, we always somehow we reflect it, I hope, moving forward in our coverage, and try to reflect it in other ways. So if I don't come to a message, please do understand that. The number to get in touch with the programme today on this and anything else we're going to discuss is 84844, or you can email through the Women's Hour website.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
I did mention this thing called women's intuition. And moving on to that and the idea of, is there such a thing? What does it mean? Is that actually not something women should be perhaps ascribing to, subscribing to, perpetuating, indulging, however you wish to think about it? It might be something we need to rethink if it is something you even think of. And that's an argument, or part of an argument, being put forward by the journalist and author of a book called Emotional Labour. The journalist is Rose Hackman, and I'm sure she can do a far better job than I than explaining a bit more about why this may be problematic. Rose, very good to have you on the programme, and thanks for talking to us today. Tell us a bit more about women's intuition. What do some people mean by that? Because I think some people have very set ideas what that means.
Right. Hello, it's great to be here this morning. So women's intuition, I think, is a kind of a bit of an amorphous thing that maybe different people might have different opinions of what it means, whether it's having a gut or an instinct that something might happen, whether it's being able to tap into intuitively the feelings of the people around you. It's a question that I really delved into at this point 9 years ago when I started writing my book, Emotional Labour, that came out last year. And so much of the feedback I was getting initially as a journalist who was looking into emotional labor is, you know, women are just better at emotions, women are just better at intuition. And so I set about trying to figure out, is this actually true? What does the research show? The research is actually pretty damning. And it shows that if women are indeed better at quote unquote intuition, it is not because of biology, it's because of subordinate positionality. So it's because we are in this society still expected to cater to the feelings, to the experiences of other people, often men. There's this seminal study from 1985 that pairs up randomly whether women or men into pairings of leaders and subordinates. And what they find is that leaders do not have to express any kind of intuition to their subordinates. Not really very surprising. And subordinates are expected to be extremely perceptive to the expressions of the leader, regardless of gender. And that's just one of the many, many, many pieces of studies across neuroscience and psychology.
Which is fascinating. I'm only coming in at this point, so because some people may be hearing the phrase women's intuition and then hearing emotional labour. And they might be thinking, how do those two things go together? And just before, I think it's fascinating to think, so are you saying there's no such thing as women's intuition?
I am not saying this. I mean, effectively, if I'm trying to be bombastic, I would say there is no such thing as women's intuition.
Right.
It's subordinates' intuition.
It's what women have had to do to survive the structures put around them in society to emotionally do a lot of heavy lifting and also thrive and survive.
It's the compensating guesswork of emotions, of predictive intuitiveness, of perceptiveness that anyone who's in a subordinate position, in this case, women in a patriarchy, are expected to do, have to do, as you say, not just to survive, but to figure ways out to not, you know, ruffle the feathers of the person who has power.
The workarounds. I mean, I love this because, by the way, something I'm really doing at the moment, and if you've been a subject of this, you may have remembered this if we've ever crossed paths, because I do cross paths with a lot of people because of the line of work I'm in. But a thing I'm doing at the moment is I'm not making conversation with people if they're not making an effort back. So if I've done a load of questions, because you can guess I'm pretty good at that, I'm facilitating. When I'm off the clock, you ain't getting it. It's my new thing. And it has happened more with men than women, as you may imagine. So I sit in silence with some men and we see what happens.
I love that so much. There's this trick with emotional labour, which is a thing in our economy, also in our private lives, of course. So many people refuse to say it's a real thing. They just say it, you know, it's nonsense, in spite of the fact that it's the central part of millions of jobs. And one of the best ways to get people to actually see it as real is to withhold it. You know, so if you're a woman and you're expected to constantly make people feel, you know, at ease around you, or you're expected to be terribly good at conversation, and you stop doing it, suddenly, you know, people are very uncomfortable because you're withholding that emotional labor that they've actually come to rely on, but they refuse to treat as real or even valuable.
Yes. And It's such a good example. I mean, you've also given examples, haven't you, in work, you know, where there's now emotional labour baked into certain roles, and those roles are often seen as feminised. For instance, waitressing as opposed to waitering, where if you weren't polite when taking somebody's food order, which is a part of that, you would be penalised. It would be commented upon. So you're right that the way to perhaps show something like this is to withdraw it. But just to go back to the difference between emotional labour or how we're talking about emotional labour and women's intuition, how do you explain those two in relation to each other?
I mean, emotional labour is the editing work of emotions a person will do on themselves in order to have an effect on the emotions of the people around them. So it's a smile, as you say, accurately, or it's questioning that you will do to make other people feel good inside, regardless of whether you're feeling good inside. It's an expectation that we have long placed on women, and we have rendered invisible, devalued, in spite of the fact that it's one of the most essential forms of work in our society, because it's the work that, you know, keeps families, communities, economies going. Yes. So what's the difference between emotional labor and women's intuition? There are so many ways in which we refuse to name emotional labor as real, but in our society, we talk about basically versions of emotional labor as real. Women's intuition is one version of emotional labor.
It's a version of it.
Absolutely. It's one of the ways in which we've internalized and actually fixed in place a set of skills and duties and activities that are not just offloaded onto women, but offloaded onto, you know, marginalized communities. So it's something that, for example, Black people might feel like they have to do towards white people. It's definitely something that gets racialized. And so on and so forth.
In some of your videos where you've been posting on this on social media, in fact, there were, I understand, Black people saying this is like racial code. This is to that point.
Absolutely. I think, you know, Black scholars have done an amazing job, especially across the 20th century, to really talk about the, you know, double bind that they find themselves in, the white mask that Black people often, whether in the UK, in Europe, or in America, which is where I'm based, you know, forced into wearing in, you know, white dominated societies. This is an existential state that actually is very familiar to any of us, any grouping. It's not, again, fixed. And I think as women, we can relate to this kind of existential state that we're forced into. And actually in my videos, as you so kindly pointed out, a lot of people commented, suddenly these big aha moments. One person commented this idea that someone looked at him, a woman looked at him, not like a hawk, but a mouse. You know, this, if you've been brought up in let's say a family where you have a father or a husband who has a very bad temper, the people around that husband very sadly are going to be taught to walk on eggshells, are going to be taught to watch that person and be very careful about what they say or do. They're going to be very good at perceptiveness and intuition. They're going to be doing that defensive emotional labour.
Yes. And I mean, there will be those perhaps, because that's why I asked you to explain about the relationship between emotional labour and female intuition, with this idea of women's intuition. There will be those women who believe, though, sort of separating that as women, they do have some intuition. There is a knowing or something, you know, whether it's related to child rearing through to just human interaction and being better at perhaps some of that. Are you saying that is there, but it's the reason that it's there? Or are you, you know, the reason that it's there is because of how we've been codified and all the points you've already made? Or are you saying it's not necessarily there? I don't know.
I'm definitely saying it's there. It's something we've been trained into being very good at. It's something that, in fact, if we don't do from a young age, we're policed. You know, if we're not smiling on the street, we will be told to smile. If we are not smiling at work, we will be told we're abrasive. We will not be given those opportunities that our fellow men will.
So what should it be called if it's not called women's intuition? Should it be called forced niceness onto women, or forced capacity?
I wrote a book called Emotional Labour, so I would argue it needs to be called Emotional Labour.
Yeah, but
I suppose
I suppose that just takes in lots of things maybe in some people's minds. But yes, you would argue that, and rightly so, I'm sure. Just with the tiny bit of time we've got left together, I think this is absolutely fascinating. And we've just had, for instance, a message from a nurse saying, "I'm a nurse, emotional labour is a huge thing, invisible, but felt by both nurses, patients and colleagues. It would become visible if we withdrew our emotional efforts, but it is a compulsory part part of the role, so this will never happen, says Elaine in Glasgow. So another example away from the serving of food through to the care of patients. So to your point, if it's withdrawn, it's noticed. What are you advising, if you are women in particular, to do when it comes to, when they've if they recognise this, when it comes to beyond recognising it, what to do about how to navigate that?
I mean, I think fundamentally, whether you call it emotional labour, whether you call it women's intuition, it is a superpower that clearly is available to all genders, but women are just better at it, you know, for now. I think that when aware with it, just like what you're doing, you know, we can choose whether or not we want to be doing it. We can become aware of the degree to which we do it. We can become aware of the degree to which it's expected of us in ways that are not necessarily always fair. I think it's really important when we're having these conversations to also remember that this is a valuable set of traits. It's a valuable skill set. So I'm not saying let's all go on emotional labour and women's intuition strike. It's just a question of actually rendering, you know, making it visible, making it valued, and ideally sharing it across, you know, people, groups. So yes. That, honestly, what about men having really good intuition? That would be great. It would be wonderful, you know, to have men who are constantly thinking about how they're being perceived and, you know, what other people are feeling.
Some will say that they do. Some will be listening to this programme, I'm sure. We have lots of male listeners. Maybe because they're listening, maybe because they're listening to this programme, we can say that they do. But it's a very interesting discussion. And I know it's a live one for you online as well with those people getting in touch on your social media feeds. Rose Hackman, the book's called Emotional Labour, but a much bigger discussion as well, I'm sure, for people getting in touch this morning. How does the theory apply with mother and child relationships, which we started to cover a message here? I feel I preempt how my children will behave because I spend so much time with them, says Nicola. I mean, that again, about, I suppose, who the caregivers are and isn't taking away from it, as you heard, but recognising it and seeing it for what it is. Very interesting indeed. And thank you there to Rose Hackman. Now, my next guest became international news when an Oscar-winning actor tracked her down in a bid to help. Carolyn Hunter spoke out about her sky-high energy bills a couple of years ago because she was struggling to make ends meet. Her annual bill covers powering electronic hoists, high central heating levels and oxygen machines. This is in order to keep her daughter Freya, now 14, alive. Freya has severe cerebral palsy and the machinery needed to help with her breathing, for example, plus heating to keep her warm, was amounting to £6,500 a year. A bill Carolyn simply couldn't pay. She decided to speak out about her struggle to the BBC a couple of years ago, and Kate Winslet happened to read the piece and ended up donating £17,000 to the family, launching a GoFundMe page in the process, which went on to raise even more. First, let's hear, remind ourselves what Kate Winslet had to say about this and about her story, about listening to what Carolyn and Freya were going through. I spoke to Kate Winslet on the programme in December 2022, and she talked about why she wanted to help.
I've always felt enormous compassion for the individual who is in a powerless position through the state of the systems, and especially when it comes to mothers and children and the treatment of children and the lack of care, the lack of acknowledgement that a life is a life. A mother has a right to mother that child in their home on their terms. And the fact that this woman, Carolyn Hunter, was going to have to possibly put her child into care because she couldn't afford her energy bills, I couldn't let that happen. I just couldn't let that happen. I read it on the BBC Scotland news page, and we were able to get in touch with her and say to her, look, we'd like to make a donation. Let's set up a page for you and make that possible. And that was how we were able to set up the fundraising page. I made a donation. And what was remarkable and utterly moving to me is that in the 6 days following my initial donation, what I had donated more than doubled.
Incredible there from Kate Winslet. Sorry for the slight delay, but reminding ourselves of what she had to say. Well, we wanted to see how Carolyn and Freya are doing today. Carolyn is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning, Emma.
Thank you for being with us. It's been a while since there's been a bit of an update, and I just wanted to start by seeing how Freya was doing.
Since the interview that I did with yourselves and Kate did in 22, it's been quite a challenging time for us in terms of Freya's health. Just in December 22, Freya became really ill with flu A, and I did as well. We both became seriously ill with it, and Freya ended up in hospital, and I was not able to look after Freya at all. And that put me into a really difficult situation, because, you know, I provide her with intensive care, and I'm probably the only person that knows Freya, you know, that well, that, you know, I can foresee what's going to happen with her health. So I wasn't able to be there, and it was difficult. And she did deteriorate after Christmas, and she ended up almost needing to be ventilated. That the sound of that, I was in the hospital with her at the time, I was still very ill, and that word created a massive trauma response for me, because the last time she'd been ventilated was 10 years before, and that was a really traumatic time for us all as a family, because my son had been diagnosed with cancer at the same time, and it just took me straight back. So it took me a while to kind of get over that situation. And Freya as well, she was very poorly for a long time.
I'm so sorry to hear that. I mean, you are, as you say, her intensive carer, and you do all of this and more, and have your other children as well, we should say. And the what you did manage to do, I suppose, through speaking out like you did, as well as other things, is you managed to raise awareness as to what's going on for those with these very high bills, and also trying to do a very, very difficult job indeed, and looking after your loved ones. And then I suppose on top of that, although it was, I mean, you tell me what it was like to have that help, you then got a lot more attention again because of Kate Winslet.
Yeah, it was. I then became, Kate Winslet gave me a platform basically all over the world. I was able to do interviews, you know, with in America, you know, and it gave, in Europe as well, and it gave me a bigger platform. And it also then meant that if there was any sort of updates about the price cap, I would be called upon to do interviews and talk about our situation, and how difficult it is looking after a child with such intensive care needs. And that I started after we got better. I started to do some work with Together for Short Lives. So I did I think it was March, I did a documentary. It was a week long documentary, a week in the life of Freya and I. And that then was that footage was used for a round table in government, and that footage was used to show politicians in Westminster and in Scottish Parliament how difficult our lives is, how difficult our lives are, and how intensive care that we need to provide for our children. And it created discussion around, well, what do we do? What does the government need to do? And you know, that then sort of triggered talking about social tariffs and looking at making homes more energy efficient. There was a bill supposed to be coming out for consultation, and you know, they wanted families to be involved in this that were suffering the energy crisis. So there was a lot of things going on. I was still doing last year different, you know, articles in the papers talking about it.
And I was going to say, and alongside this, you know, you're also continuing to care for Freya, and try and, I'm sure, look after yourself a bit as well if you can, here and there, and that campaigning side of things. Although that GoFundMe happened and did alleviate that issue, so to speak. And you know, I know you're very keenly aware of where others are not in that position. Are you still in touch with Kate Winslet? Do you plan to do anything together, or?
Yeah, Kate came to visit us last October, and she spent some time with Freya, and she also spent time with my older children, and then she took me out for dinner, which was lovely. It was nice. It was a really nice nice experience, and you know, we got on really well. Yeah, it was lovely. And then afterwards, I'd seen Kate, we had been in touch with GoFundMe, and I decided to start a fundraiser for to help families like mine with their energy over the winter. And that actually was launched on the day that Freya ended up. She ended up becoming really poorly, and she ended up in hospital again. She was really, really sick. She had 3 viruses and a chest infection to deal with. She eventually came home, and then at the beginning of this year, on the 1st of January, she became really sick and had to be ventilated, and she was on life support, which is still, we're still recovering from that. But, you know, I tried my hardest to do as many sort of interviews as I could with journalists to promote the fundraiser. And we managed to raise £10,500 from lots of kind people. And, you know, there were 70 families were supported that are supported by the hospice that Frey and I go to for respite. Yeah. So that's
incredible as well, in the midst of all of that. It's very good to talk to you again, to hear your voice. All the best to Freya as well.
Thank you.
Thinking of her and of you and the whole family. Thank you so much. Carolyn Hunter with an update on how Freya's been, which is, obviously sounds very difficult, and also how she's been, and some of the fundraising efforts, and also that relationship, that ongoing relationship between Carolyn and Kate Winslet. I just say right at the beginning of the programme, I'd tell you a bit more about a breast cancer drug sold under the brand name of Keytruda that could help thousands more women than previously thought. Dr. Liz O'Riordan, retired breast surgeon who's actually had breast cancer herself twice, is on the line. I hope to tell us a bit more. Good morning, Liz.
Morning, Emma. This is just incredible news.
Tell us more.
So Keytruda is a drug, it's an immunotherapy drug that we currently use for treating breast cancers that are triple negative, so don't have receptors for estrogen or Herceptin, and it's improved their survival. But a trial that's been going on for the last 8 years has given this to people like me with ER-positive breast cancers, and it has increased the amount of people whose tumours are disappearing during chemotherapy before the surgery. And this could mean thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of lives could be saved.
And this is different to what was thought, because is this because of new research or trials with it? Why is it so different?
So at the moment, people who have ER positives, so estrogen sensitive cancers, are given chemotherapy and drugs to block them producing estrogen. And the immunotherapy agents were just reserved for triple negative breast cancers because they can't have hormone blockers. But some very clever oncologists thought, why don't we give this to women with estrogen sensitive breast cancer as well? And it's shown that it does work and it is effective.
Wow. So that is potentially game-changing for a lot of women?
Completely. And we're now looking at genetic tests to identify the protein this drug works against, so we can actually give the right drugs to the right people rather than using a blanket response. So it's really exciting.
How soon could this help people?
Well, I don't know. It's got to go through the MHRA and NICE to approve it. But because it's been approved for triple-negative breast cancer patients, I hope we won't have to wait too long.
And for those, you know, listening to this, perhaps who aren't as familiar as you are with how all of this works, I mean, is this part of a change generally, perhaps, about the way we're approaching cancer? People will hear the word immunotherapy.
Yeah, so we know that if you have a higher risk of recurrence, there are new treatments we can give you at the beginning with chemotherapy before surgery to stop it coming back, which is saving lives. And that's what we're now looking at with targeted molecular medicine, drugs that target specific proteins. And I'm so excited to see what the future's going to hold.
I think when we last spoke, I made a commitment, and I did put it in my diary with a repeat reminder to
yes,
to keep checking myself. I haven't done it every single reminder, but I do think of you now when I'm in the shower, which is nice, Liz.
I'll tell my husband.
So that's good. I don't know, or not. But you are keen also, I know, to always stress that message to keep women as active participants in their health, aren't you?
Yeah. It's really important to check your breasts and to go for your mammograms when you're called, because we know only a third of women are going for their first screening mammogram. If you find breast cancer early, you're less likely to need drugs like chemotherapy and need a mastectomy, and it might just save your life.
Dr. Liz O'Riordan, retired breast surgeon there, with the details as sort of as someone who's a patient who's had breast cancer herself twice, with the details of this new drug. Now, I had a wonderful conversation earlier this week. Some of you may have been with me for that one. At the start of the week, with Dame Laura Kenny. She had just announced her retirement when we caught up. She's Britain's most successful female Olympian. And in our conversation, which we went to lots of different places, including the fact she doesn't actually love cycling, yes, you heard that right, that the queen of cycling, the queen of the Olympics for us from this country, doesn't love cycling. And it was her mum who got her into it. She also explained why she was stepping back and to spend more time with her children.
Just the sacrifice for me with the kids, it's just not worth it now for me. It's just too much and it's too hard to leave them behind. You know, for me, with Albie, it felt right. It felt like I was 100% committed and I was totally in for going and trying to win another gold medal. But this time it felt different from the get-go for me. Like, just initially, obviously Monty comes along and I found myself not really relying on the grandparents anymore. Like, it was me wanting to look after him. And then my training having to kind of take a back seat. I was quite open talking about having a miscarriage and the ectopic.
Yes.
I think maybe that had more of a thing to play in it than I'd ever kind of realised or anticipated. All I ever wanted for Albie was a sibling. I just always saw Albie as a big brother. And for that to maybe not happen, and for me maybe not to have another baby, then once he was here and I did have another one, I just didn't want to waste that time. Maybe I can now sit here and say I took Albie for granted a little bit, how easy it was to have Albie, how easy everything seemed at the time. I could just ask my parents to come and look after him. Was this time, I just didn't want to. Someone said to me, like, was it worth, like, can you do both? Can you have everything? And I would say, you can, yeah. Like, and I could have got back on the bike and I could have possibly qualified for the next Olympics. But you've got to think that it's worth it, because in the long run, it's your happiness that you're toying with here, you know?
Dame Laura Kenny speaking to me just after she announced her retirement from cycling. I do encourage you to listen to all of that conversation if you can, including hearing about the sport that she could have done instead of cycling. So that's all on BBC Sounds. You just go to Woman's Hour from the edition on Monday, the 18th of March. And she also, a lot of you got in touch, and I couldn't reflect these messages, all of them certainly at the time, to say how honest it was to hear her talking about it being a relief, and also that the refreshing nature of how things can change in your own life and also with your relationship, just because of other areas of your personal life, your relationship with your work can change, because that's, you know, that's what it is for her, cycling. Although it's a joyous thing for us to watch, there's just all those hours and hours and hours that go on behind the scenes. So a conversation there that a lot of you got in touch about, and if you missed it, we just wanted to flag this morning with Dame Laura Kenny, Britain's most successful female Olympian, who has retired this week. So many messages today. I do realise how difficult the programme has been in some ways, but I hope in other ways, some of you are saying this, therapeutic, as we've gone back to the story of baby loss certificates being issued in England for the first time. That was an initiative that came about last month, and some of you have received your certificates. As I said, so have I. It's here in the studio with me, and this very official looking document, which isn't actually a legal document, but is a document issued by the government, is in some of your homes now, and we've been hearing about that. Maddie says, my baby loss certificate has been incredibly healing. And although I still feel my losses, and I don't feel, though, that my losses belong in this discussion today, hence this message, I experienced many failed rounds of IVF, which were dismissed as not real losses. When I finally fell pregnant and then sadly lost my son before 12 weeks, I was deeply hurt by how much my early loss was also dismissed. The certificate is significant to me to know my son was real. My journey has come to an end without a miracle baby, which makes the certificate the only thing I have after 5 years of trying, says Maddie. I'm so very sorry. There's another message here. Thank you. Listening has made me realise I want to apply for the certificates for my three early losses. The dates are a blur, as you say, and something I'll need to figure out. My losses span the cutoff, so I'm going to wait until I can apply for all at the same time. Thank you so much for highlighting this today. I'm sobbing again. No name on that message, which is completely understandable and fine. But whoever you are, wherever you are, I hope you're going to be okay. You're going to do okay today. Perhaps be with a friend, have a cup of tea, whatever it is that can make you feel a bit better, if possible. Sometimes it's not possible, and that's the point, isn't it? And sometimes you just need to have somebody, I hope, to listen. And that's what we try to do every day here on Woman's Hour. Thank you very much for your company. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Thank you so much for your time. Join us again for the next one.
Hi, I'm India Rackerson, and I want to tell you a story. It's the story of you. In our series, Child, from BBC Radio 4, I'm going to be exploring how a fetus develops and is influenced by the world from the very get-go. Then, in the middle of the series, we take a deep look at the mechanics and politics of birth, turning a light on our struggling maternity services and exploring how the impact of birth on a mother affects us all. Then we're going to look at the incredible feat of human growth and learning in the first 12 months of life. Whatever shape the journey takes, this is a story that helps us know our world. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hey, I hear you think podcasts are all about true crime, huh? Well, wise guy, the iHeartRadio app's got all kinds of podcasts. We got stuff you should know and stuff they don't want you to know. We got Bobby Bones, Big Boy, and Lou Later. We got SpongeBob Binge Pants and Exotic Erotic Storytime. We got Doughboys, Two Dudes in a Kitchen, Green Eggs and Dan. Hey, we got ElfQuest. We got podcasts for everything on the iHeartRadio app for free. If you don't download that, well, that's not just a true crime, my friend. That's criminal.